of you who are giving me your time here right now. This is going to be really informal. I'm just going to do this from paper, no slides. And correspondingly, I invite you just to interrupt me at any time. This is, in some ways, a discussion, a directed discussion. That's the way I'm thinking of it. Especially because this is a lot of this material is being reconceptualized right now. That's really the topic, is how we have to reconceptualize something that seemed to be firmly in place a couple years ago, given some new data. It's definitely a work in progress. Okay, so the overall project, something that Jeff Booth started with Rob Clifton, the idea is, given insights that have been achieved recently about the relationship between quantum mechanics and information theory, can we use these insights in a reverse direction to illuminate the interpretation of quantum mechanics? So can we use quantum information to cast light on quantum foundations? In particular, it seems like the interpretive options for quantum mechanics came to something like a dead end in the mid-90s. So it seems to open up some new avenues for interpretive possibilities. I won't spend really any time after this short introduction talking about that aspect of the project. So instead, I'm going to talk to you about the formal results that we did obtain and how we might try to generalize these results. Okay, so let's talk about some of the characteristic features of quantum mechanics from a mathematical perspective, physical perspective, and from an information theoretic perspective. So there have been a lot of claims about what's special about the formalism of quantum mechanics, and one striking one is that the observables are somehow non-commutative. There's this matrix algebra, and you have this multiplication that's not commutative. Another perspective on that from more quantum logic point of view is that if you look at the logic of propositions, it looks like you have some sort of non-distributive logic. Instead of satisfying the standard law from Boolean algebra, P and Q or R is equivalent to P and Q or P and R. This seems to not hold for the logical propositions. This doesn't hold for the logical propositions of quantum mechanics. This is one aspect, but this doesn't seem to capture it all. There's a second aspect of the mathematics of quantum mechanics that seems characteristic. It's the Bell inequality is violated. So just to remind you, if we construct some sort of observable called a Bell observable, A1, B1, plus A2, B2, plus A2, B2, where A1, the A's and the B's are for two separate systems, Alice and Bob. These are, say, spin operators of some sort. You have some sort of strongly correlated state, like a singlet state, and actually you'll get the expectation value of this R will be greater than 2. Whereas in a classical system, you would always have this would be less than or equal to 2. So this seems like... Okay, so let me give you a little.
No, that's okay.
This is okay. Oh, okay. Sorry. Okay, this is shorthand for, in more standard notation.
That. And then you just change from uppercase R to lowercase R for no reason.
Oh, sorry. Yes, that was completely. Yeah. Sorry. Okay, this is going to be I'm also undergoing convention change in notation in my personal life, so I might make some inconsistencies here. The notation changes, I'm going from capital operators to lowercase operators. You'll see in a few minutes why that's actually important for making some general claims. But so if I start to write something that looks like an operator, it's uppercase, I think I may have slipped back into my old ways. Okay. Okay, well, what's the sort of physics behind this map? The non-commutativity seems to correspond to some sort of uncertainty principle. And the Bell inequality violation corresponds to entanglement. Okay, so the foundational question is, how do we explain why the world is like this? How are we to understand a world that satisfies these, has these features? There's uncertainty principle and measurement outcomes. There's non-local entanglement. And the goal of the original Boob-Clifton derivation was try to see from an information theoretic point of view why this would be true. What is it about the ways that we process information, that as physical creatures we can receive information, transfer information, and so on, that leads to these? And the proposal was the uncertainty principle should in some sense come from no cloning. And entanglement should come from, now there's steering, which is a general thing, like Schrodinger pointed to, where in an entangled state, somehow when you choose what measurement to make, when Alice chooses what measurement to make, she somehow determines the decomposition of Bob's density operator. Well, that has a specific manifestation in always being able to cheat on these bit commitment protocols. So if Alice tries to give Bob a bit in such a way that Bob can't uncover the bit until Alice gives him a key, but also Alice can't change, she's really committing to that bit, well, the steering seems to always prohibit, the steering does in fact in quantum mechanics prohibit such a bit commitment protocol from being secure. Okay, so the goal is then to start from these in a general framework, and that's really the key of, that's the really main focus of today's talk. What do we mean by a general framework? How could we even hope to go from these information theoretic principles back to the physics and the math? So the real question is, what kind of framework should we set this derivation in? Okay, so again, the overall goals in a sort of general sense of this project are to ask, is there a sense in which these information theoretic principles, characteristic of quantum mechanics, so the hope is somehow these will give us the essence of what it means to be in a quantum mechanical world. Now, there's another side benefit we might hope to achieve, because we'd like to do two things. We'd like to go from the information theory principles to the physics, to the mathematics, but we want to set it in a general framework. So if we're going to set it in a general framework, then we want to be able to reverse that derivation in the general framework. Now, this has a side benefit that we know that the information theoretic principles, no cloning, steering, hold for the relatively simple cases that are the main focus of current quantum information theory. So the simple Alice Bob cases where they both have qubits, or qubits plus possibly an ancilla, something like that, or, you know, some large number of qubits. But what about systems you might encounter, say, quantum field theory? Now, there are characteristic features of quantum mechanics on the mathematical side that don't hold any longer when you get to infinite systems, for example. I'll just give you one motivating example that was in the back of our minds when we started working on this. The no-bit commitment theorem for elementary quantum mechanics relies on, so no-bit commitment comes from the steering, which the mathematical representation is this Huston-Joseph-Wooters theorem. Now, the Huston-Joseph-Wooters theorem, in turn, if you go back and look at the derivation, relies on the Schmidt decomposition. So if you have a state of a bipartite system, choose a basis for the first system, there's always a basis. So if you choose xi basis for the first system, there's always a basis for the second system, and some complex coefficients such that you get that. So you get this sort of strict correlation between the x's and the y's. This is what allows you to prove the Huston-Joseph-Wooters theorem, which gives a correspondence between measures on Bob's state space, positive operator value measurements on Alice's state space, lets Alice always steer any state on Bob's system, gives you no bit commitment. Now, the Schmidt decomposition, it's well known that in quantum field theory, So the Schmidt decomposition theorem works for something like this, bounded operators on one Hilbert space, in fact, finite dimensional Hilbert space, cross bounded operators on the second Hilbert space. What's characteristic of these from the point of view of field theory is these are what's known as type 1 bundling algebras. And quantum field theory is expected that algebras of local gerbils won't be type 1. They'll be some sort of more exotic algebra of observables. So the question is, if you get in that setting, will this derivation fail? So as a side benefit, we have the original goal of deriving quantum mechanics, this general structure of the physical world from information theoretic principles. Side benefit would be, can we prove these information theoretic facts in a slightly more general setting? Okay, so do the information theoretic principles hold more generally? Okay. Now, again, the big topic for today is I actually think so. The objection that's going to come up when we see how to do this, how to move from these information theoretic principles to the physics, is we're loading, stacking the deck too much with mathematical assumptions, simplifying mathematical assumptions that make the derivation somewhat trivial. Now, on the other hand, I don't understand at all what one would mean by trying to derive all of the physics out of information theory without any sort of background mathematical principles, mathematical assumptions, if such a derivation is actually logically valid. Okay, so I'll just set that as a qualifying fact. The goal of today is not to attempt to somehow remove all possible background assumptions, so somehow we get absolutely everything out of these. The goal for today is actually just to slightly weaken the background framework so that we're not missing anything that's physically interesting. Okay, so the analogy here is to something like moving from Newtonian physics to relativistic physics. When we move from Newtonian physics to relativistic physics, we don't say, let's derive relativistic space-time based on no assumptions whatsoever about space-time. So we're not even going to assume that it's continuous, or we're not even going to assume that it's smooth or something like that. No, those assumptions are in the background, and then you choose, you say you have to weaken from, say, Euclidean space-time to a more general framework manifolds because of the way the physics works. So the same idea is going to be in play here. So we're going to have some background mathematical assumptions, but we just don't want them to be so strong that we're losing sight of the interesting physics. Okay. So now the framework assumption we started with, which seemed quite natural at the time, was the physical systems are going to correspond to C-star algebras. So I'll say quite a bit more about what these are and what types of systems they can describe. So here is background assumption one. Okay, so we were taking our cue here from algebraic quantum field theory, where there's Minkowski space-time. In algebraic quantum field theory, if you have two space-time regions, let's say O, A, O, B, then you assign algebras of operators to each of those regions, and these are supposed to be the operators that can be measured. And then you say if these regions are space-like separated, then all the operators in here can meet the operators in here. And in fact, in quantum field theory, it's important to say these are C-star algebras and not necessarily all bounded operators on Hilbert space, because different physical scenarios, you want different representations on different Hilbert spaces and so on. So, but this was the idea that we're going to have a general representation of the Alice-Bob type bipartite systems framework using just the assumption that each observer has a C-star algebra of observables. Now, this background assumption is general enough to capture the standard quantum information theory setup. So in that setup, again, Alice has operators on one Hilbert space. Bob has operators on this other Hilbert space. So I'll call from now on, this will just be A. This is B. Now, what else do we have here? Well, what is an observable for either one of them? So A and B in the general setup are going to be, we'll just assume they're subalgebras of some algebra C, as in this case. So the algebra C in this case would just be BHA cross BHB. So A and B are subsets of subalgebras of C. An observable for either one, Alex or Bob, is something that's, well, it's a permission operator, right? So it's something that has a property that's equal to its own conjugate transpose, which is equivalent to saying that its spectrum, its eigenvalues, are all real numbers. Okay, what's a state? Well, a state is a density operator, density matrix. So D and C gives this mapping, A observable goes to trace D A. Okay, now let's abstract away just a little bit from this. So what is this, what's the feature of this state? Well, we know exactly what the features are. It's just going to give us a probability measurements. The general probability measure on the projections in C is given by such a density operator, it's Gleason's theorem. So in particular, what we have is, let's represent this mapping A to trace the A by omega. And of course, this just also, this assigns you complex numbers for things that aren't observables as well. So it's a mapping of all operators in C, complex numbers, has the feature that if something's spectrum is it in the positive real numbers, then this state will assign it a non-negative number, right? It also has the feature that it assigns the identity operator 1, and of course it's linear. If you put these, so there was that first characterization, take a probability measure on the projection of the C. It's given by a density operator by this recipe. An equivalent way of saying that same thing is that if you have any linear functional on C that's positive in the sense it assigns non-negative numbers to things whose spectrum are only positive numbers, and it assigns 1 to the identity, then you get a density operator 2. Okay. So it's an abstract characterization of what the states are. Okay, now, last thing we need here is how do we represent dynamics? Well, the simplest case is just you have this vector psi in HA cross HB, and it goes to apply some unitary operator, and you get the new state. Of course, you can also take a density operator, and then you, I always get the order wrong. It's important, right, where you put the star, but and maybe we're going backwards in time, so if I get the wrong order. Okay, now, of course, we can do with observables, too. Instead of, we can just reverse this, take the sort of dual dynamics, Heisenberg feature dynamics, take an observable A, instead of mapping states to new states, keep the state fixed, map observable to new observable. Now, as we know, it's not quite general enough, because we have to consider the case where one of Alice or Bob adds an ancilla, applies unitary dynamics is applied to the whole system, and then the ancilla is thrown away at the end. And that corresponds to the abstract classification of such mappings is the following. We have a mapping phi from C to C. So now think of it as a mapping from observables to observables, Heisenberg picture. It's linear now, it's not enough for it to be positive, it has to be complete.
completely positive.
Okay, with that, that is defined for several equivalent definitions. A very simple characterization is a mapping on algebra C is completely positive if when you tensor it together with the identity and you map instead of C by itself, but C cross n by n matrices over complex numbers. So of course, this is well defined because all you're doing is you're applying to the elementary tensors in here, you're applying the map phi to the first tensor, first element of the tensor, just identity to the second element. So the mapping phi is defined to be completely positive if this is always positive for any n. And it turns out that this is actually necessary and sufficient for phi always being extensible to a positive linear mapping. So if you have a subsystem, phi is completely positive. It just means if you're on your applying phi to a subsystem, there's always a consistent extension of phi to the entire system. It gives you dynamics. Okay, and the last thing is phi preserves the identity. Okay, so this is the standard quantum information theory perspective, which is subsumed in this abstract approach. Systems are represented by C-star algebras. Here's our two C-star algebras, observable states, dynamics. So, okay.
What about measurements? Is that the dynamics and the measurements?
It's the C-star algebra approach. You can anything you talk about in the standard approach, you can talk about here too, right? So if you like, if you want to add another system, a system that's sort of observing what's going inside, of course you can do that here too. But at this stage, we're just treating, you know, all we need right now is the expectation values, right? So that just means, you know, the expected value. This gives you the expected value for A. We have projection operators. I actually should write this. And so besides these observables, we have these special observables, right? P equals P star P squared. And this is, in fact, equivalent to the spectrum of P being either in the set of the two numbers 0, 1. OK. So far, we haven't gained any sort of generality over the standard approach. But in fact, the assumption that the algebras are C-star algebras also includes the case of the classical probability theory. So let me just quickly give you that analogy. So suppose that we have some sample space X, suppose it's some sort of topological space. We want it to be nice, so let's assume it's Hausdorff, which just means any two distinct points you can separate them by open sets. If, you know, just think of this as Rn for some n. Okay, now we're going to put some sort of measure on this. As we know, not all sets are going to be measurable. And so we take some nice family of subsets, say Borel sets, take the smallest algebra generated by the open sets of this topology. And then we can consider all functions that are compatible with that structure. So if you take the inverse image, so this is an element up here, the function into the complex numbers. Now, this, of course, is not already, I've done something that in classical probability theory is not standard. Why am I taking functions into the complex numbers? Well, of course, if we're looking at functions into the real numbers, we can just take pairs of those, and then we can treat that as functions into complex numbers, right? So just take f plus ig. Okay, so this is just a simplifying move. Take all the functions into the complex numbers. We have this nice family of functions inside there that are just mapping the real numbers, those where this part is zero. Okay, now what is a probability measure? Well, it's just a probability measure, right? So a measure mu is just a mapping from Borel subsets of X into positive real numbers. Well, you can take general complex measures. The special probability measures, ones that have that feature, and they assign the whole set the value 1. And in fact, these give you trivially linear functionals on this set of things, right? So if you have a function f, you just integrate that function by the measure b mu. That gives you a linear functional. So you take f plus g, it's the integral of f plus g is integral of f plus integral of g. It's positive. Now, what do I mean by that? Because what's the spectrum? Now, here's where we stretch the, we look for the analogy with the quantum case. In the quantum case, of course, spectrum is just eigenvalues. Here, the spectrum of a function is just its range. Okay? So a positive, a self-adjoint operator is one whose range is only real numbers. So we'll take the adjoint. So we'll define for a function f, bx, we define f star by the following: f star x equals fx conjugate. Okay, then it's clear from that definition that a function satisfies the property that f star equals f if and only if the range or the spectrum of f is contained in the real numbers. So these are the analogs of self-adjoint operators, observables. And again, we can define projections. F equals f star equals f squared. That's equivalent to the range of f spectrum being contained in the two-point set 0, 1. And in fact, that's also equivalent to f being of the form, it's the characteristic function of some set S. Okay, so we have state, we have observable self-adjoint functions in this set. Projections are a special type of observable. States are given by probability measures. This is a one-to-one onto equivalence. It's clear that each measure gives you a state in this sense, in that abstract sense, a linear functional that's positive, it's normalized. And there's this theorem called the Riesz representation theorem, not the one we're used to from Hilbert space, but this analysis on this kind of space version, where each such linear functional corresponds to a measure. You can extract the measure from the function, from the linear functional. So those are our states correspond to measures. And then finally, our dynamics is some sort of flow on x, but a little bit of calculation to show you this is exactly the analog of the quantum mechanical case. If you lift that flow on x to a mapping of functions in the natural way, so you have some sort of phi takes x to x, let's write phi bar f x equals f phi x, then this phi bar is a positive normalized linear mapping on bx. Okay, so in this abstract C-star algebraic approach, we can treat these two theories on an equal footing. They're both just, so of course if we're representing a composite system here, we have two topological spaces, we have some sort of notion of putting those together, and everything works out the same in the sense of at least the general framework. Okay, so let's quickly go over composite systems. Okay, so we already remembered that quantum mechanics, we have this nice tensoring operation, which this, of course, is just equal to the operators on the tensor product of the Filbert spaces. Now, what about the classical case? Sorry, I used bad notation here because I used B. Should have used something else here. It should be like Borel functions. Now, let's, Borel functions, there's too many of them. Let's just look at the, simplify for a minute. Let's look at the case of continuous functions, just to simplify things a little. Makes no real difference for what we're going to talk about. Turns out this equality also holds. Now, there's a slight quibble here, so because in the case where these are actually infinite spaces, they're not just discrete, this can't be an exact equality, because if you think about it, take the real numbers across the real numbers. Of course, you can't get any continuous function on the real numbers across the real numbers just by taking finite linear sums of tensors of functions on the individual copies of real numbers, right? Think of the function that assigns 1 to the diagonal and 0 everywhere else, or, you know, smoothly goes down from there. So, you, of course, you just have to close this in some sort of super topology. If these are finite sets, though, this is an exact equality, which is quite clear. If these are finite sets, the continuous functions are just all functions. The continuous, so all functions on the Cartesian product of two sets is just the linear span of simple tensors of functions on the individual sets. Okay, so here's how we represent.
These complications arise when you have when you actually have a continuous topological space. If you have, like, if this big X is set of finite set of elements, then you can tell these complications.
That's right. Yeah, that's right. So, and that's the case I'm going to look at really from that. I mean, in today's talk, the continuous issues that I said are interesting in and of themselves. Like, can you do bit commitment with, you know, really large C-star algebra or something like that? That's not really in my focus. So let's, in fact, for the rest of today, think of all of our C-star algebras as having linear dimension finite. Okay, so that's true, of course. When you have finite dimensional Hilbert spaces, HAHB, of course, the set of operators on those is also finite dimensional vector space. Same with this. If you have finite space, you know, discrete finite sample spaces, right, and there's something like 0, 1, 2, then the space of all functions from those to complex numbers is, of course, just a three-dimensional vector space. Okay, so let's just look at that case, and then we have these nice equalities. Okay, so the general framework here, well, I said before, the motivation is not to just sort of come up a priori with this really abstract framework. Somehow we're going to derive the right framework just by thinking hard. Instead, what we're doing is we're saying, what's a framework that's general enough to capture these cases we're familiar with? So we have the quantum case that's been very fruitful for information theory recently. We have the traditional classical probability theory case. Now we have a framework where we can just say they're both representing observables by self-adjoint operators in a C-star algebra, states by these positive normalized linear functionals, dynamics by these completely positive linear mappings on the algebras, and so on. Okay, so now we can ask questions like, what distinguishes the classical case from the quantum case, and so on. Okay. I'm going to leave that up there since the overall framework that we're working in. Okay, so the goal now, the goal of the original derivation is to say within the C-star algebra framework, and again, I haven't written down, so to speak, the axioms, which would just be a bit tedious, but just abstract away from what we've written down these two cases, and that's really the idea of C-star algebra. And in fact, if you're only working, as I suggested, with finite dimensional C-star algebras, in fact, you can just think of these are direct sums of matrix algebras. So a C-star algebra, for purposes of today, is just something like this. M1 plus dot, 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 direct sum, MN, where these are some, we can take these, in fact, in ascending, non-decreasing dimensionality, so you're having something like 2x2 matrices, or, you know, just the complex numbers, a copy of 2x2 matrices, and so on. The classical case then is just the case where all copies are the complex numbers. That's the only case of commutative. In this direct sum representation, the commutative case is where each copy is C. Okay. Multiplication is just the pointwise, so even if you take two things from here, A1 and it's just pointwise, so the multiplying these two together is A1, B1. So this is just some, tell me your number n, and this is n by n matrices over C. So I use bad notation from before, because before I wrote mn is n by n matrices over C. But here I just mean now, each mi, for each I there's some n, such that mi is the n by n matrices over C. Okay, so there's actually quite a bit of technical work, and there's a huge sort of gaping technical gap between what I just said and what I now said that I'm not going to try to fill in. That is, if you restrict to the case where your C-star algebra is finite dimensional, then in fact it has a representation like this.
So any operator
is this? Yeah. Okay. So for any C-star algebra, if it's a finite linear dimension, and you do some sufficient amount of work, you can find a decomposition like this, and it's isomorphic to that. So in a sense, already this is the sort of thing that's going to make us really suspicious, because this seems not nearly general enough, right? We want to represent every physical system as having observables in this direct sum of matrix algebras. That seems very close to quantum mechanics, right? Not very far away at all, not very general. Okay, and I think that the illusion of generality comes from the fact that in the infinite dimensional case, this decomposition is not true. Of course, it can't be. This is, you know, a finite dimensional object. And if you have infinite dimensional C-star algebra, of course, you can have a representation like this. But actually, I think it's not really. I mean, the truth is, if you examine closely, this is sort of really what all C-star algebras are like. They're really all like this. Maybe a lot bigger, but like this. Okay. Okay, so the claim is now, though, that in the C-star algebra framework, you can use these information theoretic principles, and then you just deliver the physics out of those. So within the C-star algebra framework, if no cloning holds, if steering holds, and so therefore no bit commitment, then you get the uncertainty principle, you get entanglement, you essentially have quantum mechanics. So within this framework, what distinguishes the quantum from the classical is these information theoretic principles. Okay, now, I'm going to make a little aside here before I press on. I'll tell you a little bit about the derivation, and then I'll tell you about the problems and why we need something more general. But before that, I want to make a little aside about methodology here, because there's something a little bit fishy about the general strategy. So the general strategy, I said, is separate the two cases, classical from quantum, using these information theory principles. So it's like this. We have this big family of systems that are represented by C-star algebras. And so, and mathematically speaking, we can slice this family into two. These are the commutative ones. These are the non-commutative ones. And like I said, we'd like to say that this corresponds to the non-commutative one, so quantum theory corresponds to no bit commitment, no cloning. Okay, so you might think the goal is to show that although we thought the possibilities originally were all these, turns out this is really the set of possibilities, the ones over here. By these principles, you get just these. Now, there's a little methodological problem with that, and that is this dotted line doesn't cut out anything like a good mathematical division. Okay? In fact, what's to the left of this division is a well-behaved mathematical category of objects. So the commutative C-star algebras is nice in the following ways. If you have a commutative C-star algebra. Any subalgebra is also commutative. So I was talking before about tensor products. So any two C-star algebras, A and B, you can build a tensor product. In fact, with this tensor product, the C-star algebras turned out to be a tensor category. So they have all these nice properties. This is an associative tensor product. And there's this identity-like, under this tensor multiplication, object in here, a special C-star algebra that acts like a multiplicative identity, namely the complex numbers. The only one-dimensional C-star algebra. So A cross C for any C-star algebra A is just isomorphic to A. So the commutative, if you take all the C-star algebras and you restrict to just the commutative case, you still have a nice tensor category. And you don't need to throw away any of your mappings or anything like that. So this is what we would call the commutative C-star algebras is a full subcategory. And in fact, with the same tensor structure, it's also a tensor category. So it's a very well-behaved, nicely understood mathematical object. This, on this side of the dotted line, isn't a well-behaved category because the tensor unit, C itself, is over here. It's a commutative C-star algebra, so you have no tensor unit. So this isn't the tensor category, non-commutative C-star algebras. Similarly, if you take a non-commutative C-star algebra, not every subalgebra is non-commutative. So you don't have this property where you can infer things about any sub-object from the properties of the object. Now, this, of course, is very abstract with C-star algebras, but this is really true. Think if you're more familiar with categories, say Hilbert spaces, you wouldn't want to try to prove a theorem that relied on only Hilbert spaces of dimension 2 and greater. You wouldn't want to say the world is only represented by Hilbert spaces of dimension 2 and greater, or something like that, because you take a Hilbert space, it's always isomorphic to itself across a one-dimensional Hilbert space. Okay? So you always have this special case that looks very classical, lurking inside everything. So this just raises a little worry about methodology, because it seems to me, given these facts, that what you want to do, what you don't want to do is say, we have a general framework, we're going to impose an axiom, say no cloning, and then we're going to restrict to this side, because that leaves you with something that mathematically is ill-behaved. Okay, so instead, the perspective needs to be something different. Like, we used to think that cloning was possible, so we used to think these weren't real possibilities. But now we know there are some systems, not all systems, but some systems for which cloning isn't possible. And so we need to enlarge the framework and include these. Okay, but this is coming, again, this is coming from a very abstract mathematical perspective, just to something that seems to me a little bit worrisome. Yeah?
I have a comment, but maybe I can leave it until the end.
No, please ask.
I guess I think this is sort of related on that. Perhaps what we want to do is, rather than just drawing the line there, says, well, within the non-commutative things, there's a certain subclass that we would really want to think of the quantum-like theories. And my worry has to do with what's up on the upper board, where you've got non-commutativity next to the uncertainty principle. But now, it's true that your algorithm of being infinite only if all fewer states are dispersion free. But when you get to the non-commutative thing, you know, there are non-commutative algebras that have no dispersion free pure states, and there are non-commutative algebras that have some dispersion free pure states and some dispersion pure states that aren't. And it's the complete lack of dispersion free pure states that we think of as the uncertainty principle kind of thing. So I wonder if there's some other principle we might want to add to say, well, not only are we just getting non-commutativity, but we're getting complete absence of dispersion-free pure states, and then I feel more comfortable that we're in the quantum realm.
Yeah. So inside this side over here is these sort of extreme cases, right? Really non-commutative, right? So something like M2C. Where the center of the algebra, the things that commute with all our observables, is just the identity operator. And that's
that.
Oh, right. Yes. Right, over there. Okay, so you might want some sort of derivation. It's, you know, principles in place.
Right.
They give you those extreme cases of, you know, sort of purely,
yeah,
purely quantum systems.
Right.
So there's just a slight open problem, even so, that that there isn't any, to my knowledge, any well-behaved mathematical category of the purely quantum systems. I mean, of course, you can just by fiat build a category, right? You can just throw them all into a bag and put arrows between them and say, there's my category. Make sure to fill in all the arrows you need to. But it doesn't have tensor products in the natural, in the normal way. Because, again, this special guy, C, is not, it's the tensor unit, and it's not a purely quantum system. And so it's not a really good category. Okay. So anyways, I mean, this is like I said, this was supposed to just be a little bit of an aside. This was supposed to just be, I started to worry about this when I realized this doesn't behave well, this side of the graph. So I think I'm thinking that more now in terms of enlarging rather than, you know, here's the possibility and we're restricting. We're saying we thought these were the possibilities and we're growing the set. Okay, so, yeah.
So when we're working with this framework, we have our algebra of the operators and then the states. And then the dynamics, and we can define what completely positive dynamics is. Are we typically assuming that any completely positive dynamics is actually allowed?
Yeah, yeah. So that's that is in the background here. Yeah. So there's lots of degrees of freedom that we could fiddle around with and get interesting things, right? So like one possibility is, even with commutative algebras, if you restrict the dynamics enough, you can get things that look an awful lot like quantum mechanics. Like, for example, you could prohibit cloning by just removing the math.
Yeah, step. I was thinking of a talk Rod Speckens gave here, these sort of plays of these toy theories, which are basically classical, but there's a constraint on what states and dynamics are allowed.
Yeah, yeah, and I think my intuition is that's really what's happening in Bohmian mechanics, right? It's in Bohmian mechanics. It's a classical theory kinematically. That is, you know, the observables are commutative, or the beables, they, you know, are commutative. But since they put this restriction on dynamics, they can have all sorts of quantum effects. Okay, so yeah, there's a degree of freedom here that I'm not going to play with by. So one thing that I think can be said in favor of the way you have things set up is with this definition of dynamics. So when I said that the C4 algebra is a tensor category, that's not just saying that for any two C-star algebras, you get something like this. It's also saying for any two mappings between C-star algebras. So if you have a mapping from phi 1, let's say phi 1 from A1 to B1, and phi 2 from A2 to B2, then because of the restriction of complete positivity, you're guaranteed this tensor mapping from A1, A2 to B1, B2. And now, if you're, you know, now if A1 is equal to A2 and B1 is equal to B2, this is really important, right? Because you want, if you have dynamics on individual systems, you want to be able to put those dynamical laws together and have the global system moving forward. Okay, so so let me say just a word or two about how the proof then goes, keeping in mind this fact that we really can't think of the proof, I think, as restricting down to the quantum case so much as telling us that not just the classical case is permitted. I keep on losing my eraser. Does anyone see it? Has it gone up here? Okay. Okay, so cloning okay, so you all know what this is, right? So if we had cloning, then we'd have some ready state. And some dynamics phi that gives us final state like that, no matter what the input omega is. Okay, more generally for broadcasting, we might have some input state here across the ready state. It doesn't necessarily give us a tensor product, but but gives us something whose marginal probabilities correspond to the original state here. Okay, so the general picture is so if we have omega cross sigma goes to omega, of course we can always, for a fixed ready state, this always makes sense. We can always just, there's always going to be a sort of dynamical mapping of omega into omega cross sigma. And then if we have cloning, which let's, like I said, let's think of the more general case of broadcasting. So what we have is the final state. This is just an injection of some sort. We have phi. Now, if we restrict to the first system phi omega cross sigma, then we get omega. And if we restrict to the second system phi omega cross sigma, we get omega. OK, so the picture is cloning is possible if there's a mapping. If you look at the result of these two, what you have really is you have a mapping that takes A to A cross A in a way that, so well, I'm just treating A and B here as the same system. You have to at least be able to have a copy of A inside B in order to do cloning. So saying that cloning is possible is essentially having a map of A into its tensor product that restricts on both sides to the identity. Okay, so let's write delta to this diagonal map. Delta A goes to A cross A with the feature that if you apply restriction 1 to delta, then it's the identity on A. If you apply restriction 2 to delta, then you have an identity on A. OK, now the fact is delta exists for A if and only if A is commutative. OK, and I said I would sketch that, but I'm going to skip that because we're basically out of time. So so that's the main first result, is cloning the existence of this map delta that duplicates information is, for a particular object A, is equivalent to A being commutative. OK, now there's that second part. So this seems to give you, for the when cloning is not possible, it gives you non-commutative algebras. Now there's a second part, right? I just want to say, besides just having non-commutative algebras and having an uncertainty principle, you want to also have entanglement between the two systems. And that's where no bit commitment comes in. Now there's a little snag here that I'll just mention and then set aside. So it's, again, not going to be the main target today. The snag is once you get this, so if you take the case where delta doesn't exist, you have non-commutative systems. Whenever you have non-commutative C-star algebras, you have entangled states automatically. And in fact, it's now known, it wasn't known at the time we started working on this, but it's now known that whenever you have that setup, you have two non-commutative C-star algebras, so you have these entangled states. You have the sort of steering, the Huston-Joseph-Wooter steering, and so you have no-bit commitment. OK, so in a sense, the no-bit commitment axis doesn't add to the real mathematical concept at this point. Once you get non-existence of delta for some C-star algebras, you get not only no cloning, you also get no bit commitment. And so it seems like you get an awful lot for a pretty inexpensive admission price. OK, so now, I get to the main topic here with about 2 minutes left to say anything about it. So we had a lot of build-up of this framework. And I think I can confidently say this is, you know, one of the most general frameworks where such things have been accomplished, and also has the advantage that it's not unlike some earlier general frameworks, like say the lattice theoretic framework. This framework seems to have promise for actually being fruitful for physics, because C-star algebras are an apparatus that seems to be helping with things like quantum field theory. So the question is there cases of this is not illuminating, something where it's not general enough? And there have been proposals of this sort, toy theory by Rob Speckens. There's a toy theory by John Smolin. And without going into it, those didn't seem to me to be terribly physically interesting for the point of view of, does this theorem do any work showing us what separates quantum mechanics from other plausible physical theories? There are two cases, though, I want to take more seriously just for a few minutes here. One worry is, what about this pesky assumption that about C-star algebras, the complex numbers coming in at the start. So C-star algebra is defined as a vector space over the complex numbers. So at the end, it's not too surprising if we get quantum mechanics that has complex numbers, since we fed complex numbers in at the start. So what about these other possibilities that now seem, you know, interesting to check cases of, say, where you have real vector spaces in your state space, or quaternionic vector spaces? So what would be the natural next step of generalization, where we can see what would go on differently from an information theoretic point of view if we didn't assume complex numbers? So that's one worry I want to take seriously. The second worry are these non-local boxes. So let me just remind you that non-local boxes have these very strong correlations. So suppose we have, here's box one, box two, and they each have two settings. We'll call this A1, A2, B1, B2, and say they have two output possibilities, plus one, minus one, plus one, minus one. Okay, now imagine the setup where you have the following constraints. So A1, B1 will have the same value, but with equal probabilities to get the two outcomes. So if you measure A1 here, B1 here, A1, B2 the same. A2, B1 same. But the last case, A2, B2, you're guaranteed to get different values, but both possibilities are equally likely. Okay, now, it's easy to check. If you write down the expectation values for this, so if you, let's think of this, this describes a state. And so the expectation value for A1, B1 is 1. Expectation value for A1, B2 is 1, because you're guaranteed to get same sign. And expectation value, so that's the same for these three cases, and expectation value for A2, B2 is minus 1. So if you take the standard Bell operator, if you think of these now as, you know, you can multiply A1 times B1 to get the joint probability, so then you'd have omega applied to A1, B1 plus A1, B2 plus A2, B1 minus A2, B2. This is going to equal 4. Right? 1, 1, 1, minus 1, minus, minus 1. So just put absolute values so we don't have to worry about signs and things like that. Okay. Now, these are interesting and have been investigated quite a bit recently. The fact is, you can't represent these probabilities in the C-star algebraic framework. And in fact, the next level of generality also is insufficient. So I said one thing we'd like to do is we'd like to say why we have complex numbers as opposed to real or quaternions. So the next natural step up would be, what about Jordan algebras? So what about algebras that are like C-star algebras, except you have scalars are real numbers, and all we assume is there's this Jordan-type product. So let's write a circle for that, A circle B. And it's commutative. So this is, think of this, so this is just an analogy here, or this is one special case of it. Think of this as your good old Jordan product matrices. That. And so what you get is you get something that's commutative. So A, B equals BA, but it's not associative if the composition product here is not commutative. So you don't have necessarily A circle B circle C equals A circle B circle C. Okay, so Now, why is this an interesting framework? Well, first of all, anytime you have a CSER algebra, if you do this construction, define this like this, and only look at, take A and B self-adjoint, you get a Jordan algebra. So at least it encompasses all the CSER algebras. But also there are other cases like M2R, 2 by 2 matrices over the real numbers, take only the Hermitian ones, definitely is not a CSER algebra. There's no CSER algebra to which this is isomorphic to the self-adjoint part. But this is, under this definition, a Jordan algebra. Same goes for matrices over quaternions, so H, and so on. So it's sort of next level up of generality in terms of algebras, Jordan algebras. Now, so the one might want to end and say, okay, so the next task would be to show that in the framework of Jordan algebras, in applying some information theoretic principles like no cloning, no bit commitment, maybe those are enough, maybe we need to add another principle, will at the end get us back to CSER algebras and then quantum mechanics. There are two serious problems with this approach, and so my suggestion actually is going to be this is not the right approach to take. One problem is the Jordan algebras are also not a very good category of mathematical objects. There is no tensor product of Jordan algebras, as there is for CSER algebras. In fact, there's a theorem by Hanshi Olson that shows that if, so of course, the self-adjoint part of the 2 by 2 matrices over C is a Jordan algebra. Hanshi Olson proves that if A cross M2C, now this is just, by this I just mean the linear tensor product, so you just take linear sums of simple tensors. If there's a product that gives you a Jordan algebra, where this is a Jordan algebra, this is a self-adjoint part of the 2 by 2 matrices, then in fact A is a CSER algebra. Okay, so there's the only time you really have the natural tensor product for Jordan algebras is when it's a CSER algebra. Okay, so that's one problem. There's a related problem, that is, what about this issue of dynamics? So we want to have, be able to talk about dynamics for subsystems that extends to dynamics of larger systems. Well, first you don't have a tensor product, so what would that even mean? But for CSER algebras, complete positivity is equivalent in terms of the state space to saying that dynamics, when you think of dynamics as moving states, it preserves orientation of state space. So think of the Bloch sphere, and it has two possible orientations. And if you think about all the possible quantum dynamics on that, though, including completely positive dynamics, they always preserve whatever orientation you put on the Bloch sphere. State spaces of Jordan algebras sometimes don't permit orientation. So, for example, the disk. But if you don't permit orientation, there's no notion of preserving orientation. There's no natural restriction between, no natural distinction between purely positive, just plain old positive, and completely positive. So there's no, at least obviously natural way to say which dynamics are permissible. Okay, now, there is a possible response to this, and I'm taking this, this is motivated by something that John Barrett says in a recent paper, and that is, well, we could just get past that and say, instead of looking for some natural distinction between, say, positive and complete positivity, let's just call a dynamical mapping of a system well-defined if, whenever you add another system, it extends, at least with it identity, at least. So phi would be well-defined if phi cross identity is positive for each composed system. Now, of course, to do this, this is a suggestion for working this framework, but we have to make sense of this very notion of composing. So let's just set that aside for a minute, because the other issue is more serious, and that is, even in Jordan algebras, you can't have non-local boxes. And the idea is because the Jordan algebra product, I didn't mention this here, but the Jordan algebra product must be distributive. So A1 circle B1 plus B2 equals A1 circle B1 plus A1 circle B2. This means that, it takes also a little bit of work to do this, but the mapping A, B, take A, B, and give me a state on Jordan algebra, say omega, this mapping is in fact an inner product. Which is, this is, you know, obvious, suppose you're working with 2 by 2 matrices over real numbers, and say this is the trace, then of course it's obvious, right? Of course if you take two things, You take the trace of their Jordan product, you get an inner product on these operators. Now, using that fact here, though, if you write in a Bell operator, and then you use distributivity to distribute the V's here, so this is, should be a Jordan product now here. So if you have omega A1 circle B1 plus B2 plus A2 circle B1 minus B2. Now, straightforward manipulation with inner products. If you remember, this now gives you inner products. This looks something like this. It looks something like A1 inner product B1 plus B2 plus A2 inner product B1 minus B2. Well, straightforward calculations will give you that this is less than or equal to, I'm sure to get the number. What is it? In this case,
sinusoidal
2 root 2, right? Yeah, this is so this also holds for Jordan algebras because of the distributivity of the product. Okay, so if non-local boxes are interesting physically, then it's a non-starter to work with Jordan algebras to illuminate the question of why the physics of our world is quantum mechanics, because you can't explain the difference between, I mean, you can't even encompass the case of the non-local boxes, so Jordan algebras are non-starter. Okay, so what framework should we use then? Is there any hope to do this in a sort of, in a rigorous way? Well, there's one theorem that I want to mention in conclusion by the mathematician Landau at King's College in London. So the next natural step up in generality is what you Siegel algebra. This is after Irving Siegel. This is a very little known mathematical object. There was a paper by Siegel in roughly 1950 where he describes this framework. There's a response by another mathematician, Sherman, where he says he has some counterexamples to conjectures, and then basically the mathematical literature on this topic peters out. Basically, a Siegel algebra is Jordan algebra minus distributivity. So you don't require distributivity. There's another intuitive way to think of it, though, from the point of view of physics. Why would Siegel algebras be a natural place to start? Siegel algebras are the most general framework that permits spectral decompositions. So each A in a Siegel algebra, A can be decomposed as a sum, lambda 1, E1, plus lambda n, En, where these are projections. These are spectral values for A, okay, which seems a basic prerequisite for describing experiments, outcomes, for treating this as, for treating assignments of numbers by states to this as expectation values for outcomes. Okay, now Landau's result says for any set of non-signaling correlation data, there is a Siegel algebra A and state omega of A such that, and then dot, 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 the operator, there are operators in A that give you the correlation data as you'd expect. So the joint probabilities, let's just write up one example. So if you are given correlation data, say probability that A1 equals I equals I, and B1 equals J, that's going to be equal to, in this state, omega, A1 circle. Actually, this is that's not, this is only true if these are projections, right? I should write probability that A1 equals 1, B1 equals 1 equals, and this gives you the probability for expectation of these things. Like there's really one probabilities here, but okay. So that's Landau's theorem that says, at least in this case, so when you have correlation data that's not signaling in the sense that the outcomes on one side can't change the probabilities for outcomes, or can't, you know, measurements on the one side can't change the probabilities for outcomes on the other side, in that case, at least you can describe a Siegel algebra. So this framework can't be, it's definitely general enough to capture non-local boxes. The problems that we're left with, though, is, like I said, this is a framework that not much is known about. So there's quite a bit of mathematical work to be done. There's also the question of how does this relate to other proposals that we have in the literature. So, for example, Hardy's framework of representing probabilities by vectors, which has now been followed up on by John Barrett. Is there some way to naturally see whether there are theories in their approach that can't be represented in this approach or vice versa? So, anyways, I'll just leave that as an open question. And the general question then that we're left with is how to proceed at this stage. Where should we draw the line? Because like I said, I don't see any reason to expect that we'll be able to derive which mathematical framework is correct from the physical postulates. I think we'll have to make some strategic decisions beforehand about which framework is the most fruitful for representing the contrast classes between interesting physical theories.
All right, well, I had a few questions. Are there any others?
So I was wondering what's the motivation for thinking of the Jordan product to be the product of subsystems in literature? Because I mean, I can imagine a theory that's described by a Jordan algebra, but
yeah.
It's not the same.
So, yeah, why should we get this? Yeah, we have to get, so this operation, which just tells us for any two observables, we get some other observable, right? So why should we think of this as, why should A circle B expectation of this be the joint probability for A and B? Well, one thing we could say is just that we're going to try to set it up so that that comes out true, right? We're going to try to set it up so we can calculate joint probabilities in this way. Now, is there a better way to represent joint probabilities? Maybe. I actually don't know. I mean, this is a standard, right? This is a traditional. I mean, of course, it's certainly the way we do it in quantum mechanics, right?
Well, I mean, if you consider the algebra of quantum operators as a Jordan algebra,
So if we have Alice and Bob, then they're, so Alice and Bob, their systems are compatible with each other, right? So then it is, so then A circle B equals traditional quantum mechanical product in that case. Yes, it depends on, so A circle B gives us joint probabilities. And in fact, we wouldn't want to talk about joint probabilities for incompatibles anyways. We could talk about transition probabilities. But so when we have compatible observables, then this will give us the traditional calculus.
I guess the claim is just that these Siegel algebras can reproduce the correlations. And you're free to impose how it's supposed to work when you're talking about probabilities.
There's another, so I said at first that there's, the basic framework here is you have events, or measurement outcomes, you represent those by projection operators, and states give you probabilities. But there's this additional thing coming now about joint probability. You have to talk about some sort of compatibility relation. And you're free to, you know, you're free to set it up how you want to, but the claim here is yes, you can, given correlation data, set it up in such a way that the Jordan product will give you the joint probabilities. Projections.
So you discussed, I guess, C-star algebras, Jordan algebras, Siegel algebras.
We'll
have the word algebra.
Yeah.
And so that begs the question, why an algebra? What is it? What is it? I mean,
Good question. No, that's good. Why even care about algebra? Okay, so let me say something about it. I promise not to stop me if I go on too long, because I could give another talk. But this is a very strong contrast between, say, your approach, where there's no algebra inside, right? You have vector space probabilities. Here's the connection, I think, and it's something to be worked out further, though, and especially in relationship to the Hardy-Barrett framework, that is, suppose you have a convex set, so states. So as long as you just assume, as long as you assume that any two states can be mixed, okay, then typically your observables they maps their, you know, you can think of this in dual ways. They either map states to numbers or states map them to numbers. But at the very least, they preserve the convexity, right? If you take the expectation value of an observable in one state and another state, and you mix the two states, you should get the mixture of expectation values, right? So what that, mathematically speaking, that means they're affine functions on K. Okay, so at least all observables are this. Maybe all of these are observables. Leave that as an open question for now. Now, if all of these are observables, at least the observables are a vector space. Because if you take two affine functions and you sum them, you get another affine function, for sure. But it's also not true. There's no immediate sense in which, so the characteristic thing about algebra is having a product of some sort. If f is an affine function, f squared is almost definitely not an affine function, right? I mean, squaring a function doesn't preserve this. Typical sort of affine function, right? You know, just sort of linear. So that's not the right approach. That's not what gives you a sort of product. Some convex sets have this feature they're called spectral. This is a term from mathematicians Alfson and Schultz. And if K is spectral, then each affine function F has this nice decomposition where these are. Now, I can't say anything yet about these being projections because we don't have enough products, so what it means to be a projection. But it has this nice decomposition where these correspond roughly to functions that are one on a face of the convex set and then zero on the opposite side, so to speak. So a typical example would be like if you took this convex set, one of these E's would be something that's one here, zero here, and then, you know, continuous between the two.
So they can distinguish the states?
Yeah, that's right. These are basically give you your projective measurements, these E's. So not all convex sets have this feature of being spectral. In fact, in two dimensions, only the simplices, this and this, and things with this that are called strictly convex, so they're like that, are the only spectral two-dimensional convex sets. And this is equivalent to, so if you then have this sort of decomposition, then you can just define by stipulation. So these E's will have the special property of their squares will be affine. And then you can just, by stipulation, define the square of F to be okay, this, and now let's, but actually think of this as F circle F, so it's like a Jordan product. That's enough, actually, to give you a non-distributive algebra, if you can get this far. Because then you can define, for general F and G, you can define F circle G equals 1/4 F plus G, F plus G minus F minus G. I mean, this is just now a stipulation. But this actually gives you a Siegel algebra product.
Okay. So that sort of demonstrates, that's interesting, demonstrates that if you've got spectral property, then at least not how you can work out how to set up something.
Yeah, you can get a product.
So what about the other round? Why, from a conceptual point of view, why would you want to have a product operated in the first place?
My inclination is actually you don't. My inclination is it's special worlds where you do.
Right.
My inclination is.
But by starting with an algebra of any kind, you're assuming that you must have this property in the world.
Yeah, I think. Let me put it this way. I find it, and maybe this is just a failure of my intuition, if you give me a convex set that's not spectral, I actually have a difficult time thinking of how to do physics, describing what experiments are. Let me give you one example. This is an example I mentioned to you the other. I know we were on our way to dinner, so I didn't get to talk it out. Actually, now John's here, so this is the right time to give the example. In John's recent paper, he has a description of the local state spaces of these canonical boxes. So, you know, take Alice's state space, and it's like a square, right? So, there are these pure states where A1, you know, let this be the A1 axis, let this be the A2 axis, and so you're at 1, 0, 0, 1, 1. 1, 0, 0, 0. Okay, so these are the pure states where A1 is 0, A2 is 0. So you have a common dispersion-free states, no uncertainty principle. Okay. Now everything looks, I mean, this doesn't make no sense, right? I mean, then you now have convex, it's a convex set, you can mix states. But now let's ask about this thing, which seems to make sense intuitively. What about the observable A1 minus A2 squared? Okay. Its expectation value in this state is 0. And in fact, it's dispersion free, right? I mean, if that's our intuition is, this definitely is 0 in this state. It's definitely 0 in this state. It's definitely 1 in this state. And it's definitely 1 in this state. Which leaves the following puzzle. If we're in this state, what should the expectation value be? Because this state, the center point, is an equal mixture of states that assign that 0. So its expectation value should be 0. But it's also an equal mixture of states that assign it 1. So its expectation value should be 1. So this just shows that this is not a spectral. This is one way of saying it's not a spectral convex set. There is no observable A1 minus A2 squared. There is no affine function on this state space corresponding to that label. Now, does that mean we can't do physics? Well, probably not. It just means we can't do physics in the way we used to do it, right? You can't just build functions out of observables and expect them to be observables. So, is spectrality like, you know, should we? Well, let me say two things about it. I honestly don't, I mean, this is something I don't really want to take a stand on at all because I'm just interested in what different. And what comes out in the different approaches. But notice, by the way, I think this is a really interesting thing, is this is not spectral, but still it represents the probabilities for the non-local boxes. Landau's theorem says there is a spectral convex set that represents the same probabilities, because Landau's theorem says given these non-signaling correlations, you can build a Siegel algebra. The state space of the Siegel algebra is always spectral. And so there's another state space that represents the same correlations. So I'm not sure, you know, I don't want to make any sort of argument that the algebraic approach to a spectral set is preferable. I think both approaches probably need to be explored.
Yeah, that's interesting.
Yeah.
Okay, well, we can carry on discussing as long as we want. Perhaps I'll just ask if anyone else has any questions. No? Okay, well, I'm speaking.
Thanks.